Hello everyone, thank you for coming to the talk. So last talk before lunch, so I'll try to make things interesting, maybe a little bit. I'm Gibran and I'm going to be talking about optimal protocols for non-locality distillation. So it's kind of the opposite side of things in terms of non-local correlations or quantum correlations rather than the discord version that we just heard about. And this is joint work with Peter Hoyer at University of Calgary. All right. So kind of the show of hands, how many computer scientists in here? 1, 2, 3. All right, so not all physicists. Okay. So it might be slightly surprising, computer scientists kind of asking these questions. So the line of research, this line of work is slightly motivated by the following fact: how unique is quantum physics as a theory of reality? And is it really the only physical theory of reality? Should we expect other theories to be out there that still give kind of reasonable predictions or are in agreement with experiments? And if there are such theories, what kind of axioms or what kind of principles should we expect there to be that would derive that kind of theory? So you know, kind of in the usual quantum physics course, you have those 5 axioms based on which we get quantum physics. Are there kind of similar principles and axioms out there based on which we can derive other reasonable physical theories? So that's kind of the very foundational motivation for this work. So for the purpose of this talk, the framework that we are basically considering is just the following: a bipartite system, 2 parties, Alice and Bob, receive input bits X and Y, so just input bits X and Y. Once they receive the bits, no communication allowed between them. They are allowed to share some kind of correlation source, could be just a random bit, random variable, could be an entangled state, could be some other kind of hypothetical resource. Once they receive the input bits, they're allowed to do some kind of local procedure operation on their own sides without any communication, and based on the output of their kind of local processes, give output bits A and B, and we are interested in the correlations they can obtain in the outputs A and B, given that they received inputs X and Y. So kind of the usual non-local correlation scenario. And formally, we will define a player strategy in either the following matrix or vector notation based on whichever is easier to use at the moment. So, for example, in the matrix notation, each row is essentially just a probability distribution giving the probabilities for the player to output the given outputs, fixing their input. So each row is essentially just a probability distribution, and in kind of the vector notation, we're basically just taking each of the rows, adding, transposing them, making a vector out of just adding each at the bottom of each other. And the usual kind of positivity and normalization constraints apply on all the entries in the vector, right? So for example, for our scenario, we only have 4 possible inputs, so we can kind of think of our vector as being partitioned into kind of 4 probability distributions, right? Each with 4 entries. Similarly, since we said we are interested in correlations, we want to specify how are we looking, going to define our correlations. We can define our correlations again using a similar matrix or a vector notation again. And our correlations that we're interested in are just given by the fact that we want the XOR of the output bits to equal the AND of the input bits. Okay, so that's the definition of what correlations we want to reproduce. And so you can kind of think of it as a game in which whenever the correlations match this requirement, the players win. Whenever they do not match these correlations, they lose. Hence the +1 and the -1 entries. Okay. This is basically based on a well-known Bell inequality known as CHSH inequality. This is essentially the correlations given by the CHSH inequality. And we'll kind of get to that inequality as well. But for the framework that we are considering, this is kind of the only unique inequality that exists. And I'll get to that. Okay. So to begin with, let's just think of our sample space. We had our framework in mind: all possible inputs, all possible outputs, only 2 players. So think of this box as defining the region of all possible player strategies that exist. Okay. So any player strategy will exist somewhere inside that box. Now, classical players. What are classical players? Essentially players just sharing random variables with each other. For them, the distribution is going to have the following simple structure, right? That the output that they give, the bit A, is just going to be a function which is dependent on the input that they receive and the random variable that they have shared. And similarly for Bob as well. And then they can have a kind of a convex combination of each of the individual strategies to come up with a general strategy. So this is basically just saying they can have a probability distribution over which strategy they are choosing, and each of their strategies individually is just dependent on the input they receive and the random variable that they shared. And that gives rise to the Bell inequality, which was shown by CHSH, Clauser, Horn, Shimoni and Holt in 1969. And they basically showed that, okay, if these are the correlations that we're interested in, AX or B is equal to X times Y, then the following kind of expression, you sum up all the winning probabilities and subtract the probability of all losing events. This kind of term or expression is always less than or equal to 2 for any strategy which has the following structure. So this is known as Bell inequality, and this specific example is known as the CHSH inequality. Okay, so that was the kind of first individual result, saying that okay, local probability distributions are restricted up to the value of 2, and so you can think of all the classical players as being restricted inside that big box that we initially started out with. They are restricted into that small kind of tilted square now. The same paper, CHSH, showed that no, that if the players were to share a quantum entangled state, in this specific case an EPR pair, they can do much better. Rather than obtain this value of 2 for Bell inequality in this specific case, they can obtain the value of 2 square root 2 for this inequality. And this kind of matrix at the top essentially just gives the correlation that the probabilities that they are able to obtain using specific chosen measurements on that EPR pair. Okay, we are not really interested in the choice of measurements at the moment. And then Cyrilson's paper showed that this value of 2 square root 2 is actually optimal for the scenario. You cannot hope to find a better strategy even if the player shared some higher dimensional entangled state, many copies of an entangled state. Regardless of the quantum resource they are sharing, this value of 2 square root 2 is optimal for a quantum strategy. And then the one thing that we will note and make use of later on, that is this inequality is a necessary but not sufficient witness for a quantum kind of resource. So if we know that there are players who just played this game and obtained the value of 2 square root 2, we do not necessarily know that they are quantum players. They could exist some other resources which are outside some probabilities that cannot be reproduced by a quantum state, but yet gives the same value. Okay. So it's a necessary but not sufficient condition. And so we think of the... This one?
No, the next one.
Okay. What is what?
I don't see why it's...
Oh, so think of the optimal probability is just going to be some kind of deterministic probability. So let's just say all the players always output 1. And so in that case, you will have 3 over here and 1 over here. So 3 minus 1 will give you 2. And that's actually the optimal strategy. Since any classical strategy is just going to be a convex combination of deterministic strategies, the optimal value, you can just kind of explicitly kind of enumerate all the deterministic strategies, and 2 is the optimal value for any deterministic strategy. And
sorry, if you sum over A and B, those are either 0 or 1.
Right. A, B, X, and Y are bits, so they can take the value 0 or 1. Any other confusion? Feel free to include. No? Okay. So we have this picture that quantum strategies, they kind of take a bigger area than our kind of initial smaller box of the classical strategies. And the nice thing to note is that they actually do not have these kind of finite number of vertices that the classical strategies had. These finite vertices, number of vertices correspond to the deterministic strategies in the classical case. We do not have that situation in the quantum case. And now we kind of step back for a moment and look at the framework that we were considering. We started out asking, well, what are kind of general principles that we can have? And so in the framework that we had, we initially started out saying, okay, they will receive, Alice and Bob will receive some input bits. Once they've received that, those input bits, they will not communicate. What kind of principle, what kind of constraints kind of specify that restriction? And those are given by the no signaling constraints, which are given over here. So each of these kind of set of constraints are basically saying that the marginal distribution of Alice or Bob remains unchanged regardless of how Bob or Alice's input changes. So if Alice's input changes, that should have no effect on how Bob is kind of coming up with the strategy or the probabilities that he has. And similarly, Bob's output should not be dependent on Alice's input. So the probability that Alice outputs A is independent, Alice outputs A is independent of what Alice receives and vice versa. Okay? And once you kind of come up with a set of constraints, you can construct again, all right, what are the set of clear strategies that are obtainable using just these set of constraints? And it turns out that they allow a bigger region than the quantum region. So you actually get kind of beyond the quantum region. So for example, Popovsky and Rodick actually explicitly stated the following strategy, which is essentially just uniform distribution over all the winning events. This is a no-signaling strategy, it could be just verified, and it attains the value, maximum value for the CHSH inequality of 4. Okay. And you can then again kind of think of this as a hypothetical resource. We know that quantum physics does not allow it, but we know of no good reason why it doesn't allow it. So we can take it as a resource and say, okay, what can we do with this resource? So kind of summarizing that information, classical strategy attains 2, quantum strategy attains 2 square root 2, no signaling strategy attain value of 4. Why doesn't a physical strategy allow us to attain the value of 4? Kind of take that question one step further. What would be the implications of a strategy of a reality that would allow that value to be attained? Okay? And so in some sense, we are basically saying, well, we kind of assume what we are implying is wrong. What will happen in that case? And so what if horses can fly? What will be the consequences of that? So we start out with the principle of information causality. It's kind of a direct implication of Holleville's bound. And it's basically, and you can also think of it as a generalization of the no-signaling constraints. The no-signaling constraints were basically saying, if Alice doesn't send Bob any bit, Bob cannot receive any bit. And this is basically just generalizing it, saying, if you transmit n classical bits, the other side can at maximum receive or gain an information of n classical bits. Right? Now, notice that this breaks down if the communication is quantum. So for example, if Alice was sending n quantum bits, then you can use superdense coding and actually have twice the information gain. But for this principle, we're basically saying communication is classical. So sending n bits will end up having an information gain of n bits as well on the other side. Now, this has been shown to be true for all strategies that violate Cyrilson's bound. So any strategy that is in the no-signaling polytope that we identified. So this then kind of becomes a physical principle that we kind of identify as. Any strategy that will go beyond Cyrilson's bound will allow you, the other side, to attain an information gain of greater than n bits. That's why then we kind of have an intuition of why the no-signaling polytope is a no-go region for quantum physics. However, we do not know whether this information causality constraint holds for strategies that do not violate Cyrilson's bound and are yet not quantum. So that's kind of an open area. The other kind of implication that we can look at is communication complexity. How many bits are required for Alice and Bob to compute a function? And it was shown that if they had a non-local box, that hypothetical resource to begin with, they can compute any function they want to using a single bit of communication. And if this doesn't seem strange, think of it this way. Alice and Bob are on Mars and Venus respectively. They have a huge 4 gig, 6 gig, any size file on the computers. And they want to check whether the files that they are sharing are the same files. They can check that with using just a single bit of communication, independent of the size of the files. And we don't expect that in a real world. It's basically saying, you know, you never really need to communicate with anyone else. As long as you've got shared resources, you can always communicate anything to the other person only with a single bit of communication. And that's, again, something that we do not kind of find in reality. And so it kind of serves as an intuition of why quantum physics doesn't allow the violation of Cyrilson's bound. So, however, this is shown for a perfect non-local box. It was generalized to kind of noisy non-local boxes that still go beyond Cyrilson's bound. So this paper showed that, okay, you can still do better if you are, the non-local boxes are working perfectly with probability 0.91 approximately. But that still kind of leaves a gap between Cirrus's bound, which is approximately 0.85 probability, and this result, which is 0.91. What happens between this range? And so that's essentially what this R kind of result addresses. One idea of kind of closing this gap might be to use the proof from information causality and apply that to over here, which no one really has done yet. And the other is to basically say, okay, let's say we have multiple copies of non-local boxes that are weak, that are not perfect. So they are not like the uniform distribution over the winning events. But we have multiple copies of them. Can we combine them to obtain a stronger version of a non-local box? Just like you take lots of mixed states, combine them to form an EPR pair, we want to distill now non-locality rather than entanglement. Okay? So here's the kind of non-local resource that we are kind of going to work with. Rather than having kind of fixed values, our parameters are like delta i's and epsilon, and the kind of specific structure that it has allows it to always satisfy the no-signaling constraints, the pluses over here and the minuses over here. But other than that, it is kind of a pretty general non-local box. And then we can consider the following kind of distillation protocol. Alice and Bob have n copies of the non-local box. They are going to run them in parallel. They get the input bits x and y, give it to their non-local boxes, receive output bits a and b from all their non-local boxes. Then they've got this collection of n bits. They can apply any function on each of their sides. Alice can apply a function on her n bits, and Bob can apply a function on his n bits, any function they may choose. So for example, one strategy might be for Alice to just do parity on her side, Bob to do parity on his side for his output bits. So for example, if they were to apply parity, if you have a single non-local box, it just gives the value of that non-local box because it's just a single non-local box. You have two copies of the non-local box, so Alice and Bob have two non-local boxes, they obtain two output bits, they get the following value for the CHSH inequality. And you can generalize that to say, okay, now let's say you have k non-local boxes, you do parity on those k non-local boxes, a bit of calculation shows that's the value that you will obtain using those k non-local boxes for the CHSH inequality. Now, the interesting result is that that is actually optimal. So Alice and Bob do not need to apply any kind of more interesting or weird function on their side to obtain a better kind of distillation of the non-local box. Parity is good enough. So any other so the result is basically the following. Alice and Bob have n copies of non-local box. Then there exists an optimal value of k, which is less than or equal to n, such that they choose k non-local boxes, apply parity on those k non-local boxes, and the value of those k non-local boxes from the previous calculation is going to be this, and this is going to be the optimal value that they can obtain for CHSH, regardless of whatever other function they may use during that distillation protocol. Okay, so is the result here? Okay. Now, based on this, we could conjecture the following. All right, we have now access to an optimal distillation protocol. Is it possible to distill all those strategies that are not quantum, but yet below Cirilson's bound to beyond Cirilson's bound? And then the information causality result will apply and we are done. We would have shown that, okay, any strategy that is not quantum just gives weird implications. So that's the conjecture that we might think of, but it's not true. You can actually come up with counterexamples for which it doesn't work. However, is all lost? Not really, because we didn't really consider the most general possible distillation protocols. In our output bits that we had here for Alice and Bob, they can have the protocol still depend on the actual input bit that they had to begin with as well. Alice can have her output bits from the non-local box as well as the input bit she initially received. And similarly, Bob can use the initial input bit that he actually received for the function that he uses. Does that give them anything? We do not know. And other than that, they can also have an adaptive distillation protocol, which are naturally going to be much more stronger. So rather than running all n non-local boxes in parallel, you take one non-local box, take its output, use that as feedback to the second non-local box, and so on and so forth, kind of building a hierarchy. And it has been shown that, so for example, for two non-local boxes, there exist better adaptive distillation protocols than any non-adaptive distillation protocol. Okay. But does that generalize? We do not know. All right. And I conclude with the following kind of implications or what ifs. So far the talk was basically based upon, we are assuming that if quantum physics is actually kind of a unique theory, And anything that kind of violates it, so any of these hypothetical resources that we are considering, are just weird, and they will have weird implications. But what if that is not the situation? So what if the communication complexity gap that there was between 0.85 and 0.91, that actually cannot be filled? So what does that actually imply about physical theories that exist in between there? Do they imply kind of, yes, there exists a physical theory that implies a different kind of communication complexity world, or not? I don't know, but that's kind of like a general open-ended question that I leave you with. And that's all. Thank you very much.